You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
To this week's Rendezvous with a Writer, episode number 10. We're so excited. This is number 10. Who are you?
I'm not sure.
I'm Bobby Jean Bell, and my co-host here sitting next to me is
Jim Bell,
and we are so excited to have you with us tonight. That our opening music always gets my toes tapping. That was Hot Texas, written and performed by the Hot Texas Swing Band. And who was our guest tonight?
Deanne Stillman.
Oh my gosh, an award-winning author joining us. Go ahead and tell us a little something about her.
Let's do that. Let's just share a little something about tonight's guest. Deanne Stillman is a widely publicized and critically acclaimed writer. Her books include Blood Brothers, which received a starred review in Kirkus, plus was excerpted in Newsweek magazine, and won the Ohio Anna Award. Desert Reckoning, based on a Rolling Stone piece, and winner of the Spur Award, and in her book Mustang, a Los Angeles Times Best Book of the Year, and then 29 Palms, also an LA Times Best Book of the Year, and this was praised by Hunter Thompson. Mm-hmm. Let's welcome Deanne.
Welcome, Deanne.
Well, howdy, Bobby and Jim. It's really nice to be back with you after not having chatted with you for years since Mustang came out.
I know, so 2009.
I know, it's amazing. By the way, I love that lead-in music. That's really cool.
Oh, thank you. They're good friends, Alex Dormont and the Hot Texas Swing Band. They're fabulous. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. So Jim and I...
Oh, yeah, I love...
Yeah.
Go ahead. Jim, I was going to say I love Texas Swing, but go ahead.
That's okay. Jim and I have been reading, each one of us, a different book. And the first one we're going to talk about tonight in this first segment is Desert Reckoning, a town sheriff, a Mojave hermit, and the biggest manhunt in modern California history. Oh my gosh, Deanne. This book reads like fiction. I had to keep checking. Am I reading fiction? Wait, am I reading fiction? Because it's so eloquently written. It's so rich in details and complexity. It just is like I was telling you the other night, I felt like I was looking at a painting of the desert and I was immersed in all of its colors and wonders. And then the people that inhabit this space. Tell us where this story came from and give us a little backstory.
Well, first of all, thanks so much for those very kind words about my writing. I do bring elements of fiction into all of my nonfiction writing. And so it's gratifying to hear that you were engaged by the story. It takes place in the Antelope Valley, which is the northern half of LA County. It's the Mojave side of Los Angeles, over the San Gabriel Mountains, you know, north of the studios, far away from the beaches. It's very rural. It's the desert. You know, it's nothing like the stereotypical sort of view of Los Angeles with, you know, palm trees and freeways. It's remote, has its own kind of idiosyncratic population. You really have to love the desert to live there. That side of the Mojave, it's the western part of Mojave. It's very, it's kind of even more rugged than the Mojave that you find east of Los Angeles, for instance, in Joshua Tree National Park. Mm-hmm. Different terrain, different flora, different lighting. I mean, the skies are just incredibly dramatic, and it's a real escape hatch from Los Angeles if you want to remain in LA County, but be in the desert at the same time.
Mm-hmm. What draws you to the desert, Deanne? Because I have a feeling the desert speaks to you, and you've done two books that take place in the Mojave. What is it about the desert that gets you going?
Well, when I was growing up in Cleveland, Ohio, I love rock and roll, and as everyone knows, Cleveland is rock and roll central, and there have always been plenty of garage bands there, and that's great. But I never really liked ice fishing, and I just never felt at home in the climate there. You know how sometimes you just know you're living in the wrong place, or you just should. You should have been born somewhere else. I just never felt fully comfortable there. But beyond that, my father used to read a lot to me when I was growing up. And one of the things that he read was the Edgar Allan Poe poem, El Dorado. Mm-hmm. Which you may know, and I'm sure some of your listeners may know it as well. It's got that great refrain, gaily bedight, a wandering night in sunshine and in shadow, had wandered along singing a song in search of El Dorado. And I used to get lost inside that poem when my father was reading it, and I became my own escape hatch. I would wander along with that night through the desert, searching for El Dorado, and it fueled a lot of my wanderlust. Plus, there was a fair amount of turmoil in my house growing up, and again, to escape that, I would kind of live in this fantastical terrain. And I, too, started to read a lot then, and have certainly continued to do so. And I began reading, a lot about our Western heroes, Annie Oakley and Crazy Horse and Black Elk and Jesse James and the whole cast. And finding out about those characters just made me want to move out west at some point. And I also knew that I wanted to be a writer when I grew up. And one day I did move west, and I became a writer. And also, I should point out that I grew up around horses. My mother was one of the first women in the country to ride professionally on the racetrack as an exercise boy. And being around horses also added to my wanderlust and all of these elements of my upbringing kind of added up to mm-hmm. go west, young woman. I knew I had to get out of Dodge at some point.
This particular book, the first one that we're talking about, with a title that includes the words, you know, biggest manhunt, I half expected that there would be a good guy and a bad guy. And the way that you take us into the lives of Donald Cook and Deputy Sheriff Steven Sorensen is peeling back layers and layers of their personal histories. And you write about them, I would say with love, but definitely without judgment. And you provide us such insight into both of these really remarkable men who just have a bad day, I guess one might say. And I think that has to be, you know, when you were writing this, did you anticipate that you would find so much material that you would really be able to give us such an accurate portrayal of both of these unique and special men?
Well, I never really know exactly what I'm going to find, but I generally have an instinct. I did write this story first for Rolling Stone magazine, and as soon as I started to work on the article, I knew that there was much more, that I couldn't fit the whole story into 8,000 words, you know, which was the length of the piece, because I had begun talking to a number of people, family members of Donald Cook, the hermit. I mean, and there was the idea of like, there are, you know, modern day hermits living outside Los Angeles. There was that, and it was all very intriguing. And then it turned out he had a backstory with this cop whom he killed one day when this cop showed up at his trailer looking for someone else, it turned out, but Cook the hermit didn't really know that. And he was just they had a strange backstory, which was that I think it was almost 10 years to the day prior to this shootout at Cook's trailer, Sorensen had pulled Cook over for speeding on a remote highway in the Antelope Valley, and they had this, you know, it was actually a nearly fatal encounter then. And Cook, well, it just struck me as kind of paradoxical, or struck me as kind of a dance that was being completed when Sorensen showed up at Cook's trailer years later. And by then Cook himself had been doing a lot of speed, and he had a reunion with a long lost son that worked out for a while, and then it didn't. And when the son ended up overdosing in a downtown LA warehouse, Cook the hermit really kind of began degenerating. And so by the time Sorensen showed up, Cook was in really bad shape. But a really strange thing is that they were both living in the desert for kind of the same reasons. They didn't feel comfortable in civilization. They both had left Southern California. Well, they both had left LA for the desert. Sorensen was a surfer from the South Bay, and Cook had lived in LA for a long time, but neither of them could really take the city. So they went to the desert for kind of similar reasons, and they both communed with wild animals, and you know, they were solitary figures, obviously two sides of the same coin. I mean, Cook was locked and loaded and didn't really much like cops. And then one day the local cop showed up, as I mentioned. And, you know, it takes a kind of special special breed to want to patrol that part of the desert. It's, you get into trouble, it might take an hour or two for backup to arrive. So
one of the descriptions when you're writing about Donald Cook, and you say he would have his Barca lounger, you know, out in his living room, which was outside the trailer, and it was facing the east, I think, right, where he would read and every morning. And I just thought that what a wonderful picture image you gave us. Do you want to read a little something from this book?
Oh, sure. I'd like to. And about that Barca lounger, I mean, everyone has one, right, or wants one. So, like, his Cook's living room was kind of, it was the desert, so that's where he went, you know, every day to watch the sunrise to the east.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is the opening, from the opening, called A Strange Request. Alone in his small trailer, Donald Charles Cook had been singing a song. It wasn't a pretty song, nor was it a song that the casual passerby would hear on the off chance that he or she was in the vicinity of the remote little abode. No, the weird and discordant tune emanating from the trailer, always calling, calling, calling for someone to come and put him out of his misery, was broadcast on a frequency few could monitor, its sound waves fading in and out of the radio dead zones that pockmarked the vast desert expanse. But the singer was persistent and unwavering, and his song encircled the sage and drifted across the nest of the last desert tortoise. It traveled down washes cut by ancient floods and caressed the tough backs of scorpions. And one day it crossed a bajada, and the singer, yearning for his days to end, sang more furiously, sending the dirge into the higher elevations. Up a butte studded with Joshua trees and granite slabs and bobcats, and up higher until it was swept away by a Santa Ana wind, that high voltage swirl of hot air that is born in the Mojave and is said to carry messages of evil. And it wafted across the high desert scrub over mountains and sea, and was heard by sensitive souls in other lands, far-flung sisters of the man who sang his own death song. And they called each other from Okinawa and Pensacola and Arizona and knew something was wrong. So there you have a little... what was going on with this hermit shortly before he had his fatal encounter with Stephen Sorensen.
We're talking with our guest Deanne Stillman, and she just read the very opening of, and it got me from page one, A Town Sheriff, A Desert Reckoning, A Town Sheriff, A Mojave Hermit, and the Biggest Manhunt in Modern California History. Deanne, stay with us. We're going to take a very quick break. And when we come back, we're going to hear a little bit about Tuscany Bay Books, publishing friends of ours. And when we come back, we'll switch gears a little bit, and we'll be talking about Blood Brothers, the strange friendship, the story of the strange friendship between Sitting Bull and Buffalo Bill. So stay with us.
Hey everybody, Richard Polinelli with Tuscany Bay Books. And if you're a reader looking for the next best adventure for your summertime reading, or, you know, coming up on the winter, come to TuscanyBayBooks.com and check out our amazing bookshelf filled with books by some of the best authors out there in science fiction, fantasy, mystery thrillers, westerns, you name it. We've got something for you to read. And if you're an author who has just finished your manuscript and you're looking for a publisher, come to TuscanyBayBooks.com. Fill out our submission form. We'll take a look at it, and we'll see if we can get you published and get you doing what you should be doing, which is writing your very next book. TuscanyBayBooks.com. That's your place to go if you're a reader or a writer. And now back to Rendezvous with a Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell.
And we're back with Deanne Stillman, our special guest tonight. We're going to talk about, and I'm just going to hold it up to the camera. Deanne's calling in, so she can't kind of see what we're doing. So I'm holding up the cover of Blood Brothers, the story of the strange friendship between Sitting Bull and Buffalo Bill, another award-winning book, critically acclaimed book from Deanne's pen. Deanne, I think when we were chatting the other night, one of the things you said is, well, you know, there is a connection of sorts between these two books. Before we get into specifics, would you like to share a little bit about that connection?
Oh, sure. Well, they're both place-based, by which I mean place is the main character in each of them. In Desert Reckoning, of course, it's the desert, and it shapes and drives, shapes a lot of everybody's behavior and drives a story. And in Blood Brothers, the setting is the Great Plains, which also has shaped the characters and drives the stories. Both stories are Westerns. One, Desert Reckoning, is a modern Western, and Blood Brothers is set during the 19th century. So, you know, it's a frontier story, and it's all about American history. So those are some of the parallels. And then also both stories have to do with what I see as our need to reconnect with the land. I mean, we have these wide open spaces, you know, in the country that fuel kind of our dream of self. And that's why the characters, that's why the hermit and the sheriff, of course, were living in the desert, and Blood Brothers. I mean, obviously, Sitting Bull and his Lakota people, you know, were of the Great Plains, and they lived there. And Buffalo Bill Cody had come from Kansas and Iowa, and, you know, to the plains. And then, of course, well beyond that, all traveling all around the world. But
all over the world.
Both of those men were very much shaped by their terrain, and I feel that the culture clash of the white man and Native Americans, you know, of that era was very much about the land and what happens when we're separated from it. So that's something I explore. The big theme of Blood Brothers, the reason I wrote Blood Brothers is because I, when I was working on a previous book, Mustang, I found out that while Sitting Bull was traveling with Buffalo Bill in his Wild West show in 1885, when it was time for him to go home to Standing Rock, Buffalo Bill presented him with the horse that Sitting Bull rode in the show. And several years later, while Sitting Bull was assassinated, the horse was outside Sitting Bull's cabin. And it started to dance at the sound of gunfire because it was trained to do so in the Wild West show. And that haunting image of this dancing horse just stayed with me for years. And I knew that I had to look into it at some point and find out what the story was, you know. I mean, can you imagine?
I can't.
That's the image that led me into writing Blood Brothers. And you know, it's very much about the sacred and the spirit of the horse, the Wild West show. I mean, Buffalo Bill made a point of referring to it as an equestrian extravaganza. I mean, you know, so much of what went on then was all about the horse for both men. And both men were superstars of their era. I mean, Sitting Bull was highly sought after for various traveling circuses when he returned from Canada after fleeing there following his tribe's victory at the Battle of the Little Bighorn. But he had been blamed for killing Custer, which, of course, wasn't the case. So as I say in my book, his medicine was certainly all over the battlefield. Mm-hmm. But he was courted by a number of shows when he returned to the plains from Canada, and he ended up making a deal with Buffalo Bill. You know, but he was the first Native American to be paid. I don't remember exactly what he was. Received the highest salary of any cast member at the time, and he, you know, certainly in terms of stature, was on a par with Buffalo Bill. I mean, they were two giants of their era, and you know, they remain, you know, two of our most incredible figures, really.
Jim, I know you have some questions for Deanne.
Well, you know, I was fascinated by the book. We start in 1839 with George Catlin, the artist, and he has a traveling art show with his paintings if he takes to London. And we go from there to, you know, we're going past the Mountain Man. We're going up to the Civil War. We're covering the Battle of Little Bighorn. We're leading up to Sitting Bull assassination, and we're falling right into Battle of the Wounded Knee. We cover a lot of ground here, right? And a lot of different things.
She takes us on a journey, a history journey.
Which is really, you know, it's great for the reader, right? We cover a lot of things, and I studied some of these things, but, you know, you brought in a lot of different facts and things that they really didn't know. We appreciate the fact that these are almost like a fiction book with characters are created in a personality of their own. And I didn't know that they didn't come to me as friends necessarily, but it was kind of like I knew something about them, you know? And we're talking, you got Annie Oakley, you got Wild Bill Hickok, you got Crazy Horse. In addition to Sitting Bull and Buffalo Bill. Now, Buffalo Bill didn't want to join up with, Sitting Bull didn't want to join up with Buffalo Bill in the show. I mean, he was approached a couple of times. And from what I understand, it was his liking of Annie Oakley. They kind of sold him on the show.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Yeah, it's certainly this strange alliance between Buffalo Bill and Sitting Bull wouldn't have happened without Annie Oakley. When Sitting Bull returned to the plains from Canada and was living at, I think it was Fort Yates, the army agent in charge of him sometimes took him on tour, and at one point they visited St. Paul, Minnesota, and Annie Oakley was there giving a shooting exhibit with her husband Frank Butler, and Sitting Bull was quite taken with her shooting skills and evidently sent her like a note backstage at that time and introduced himself and from then on, they kind of became fast friends. And in fact, at some point, Sitting Bull gave her the nickname of Little Miss Sure Shot, which was a mistranslation. What he really was saying was he was really calling her little person who does good things. But at any rate, I don't think that she might not have become so famous.
I didn't know that. That's what's so fun. You bring out all kinds of things that we.
Yeah, I know. As I say, I talk about it in my book, that he actually, you know, to use today's parlance, he kind of provided her with a brand, you know, which was Little Miss Sure Shot. So then shortly after their St. Paul meeting on Buffalo Bill was, his show had traveled to New Orleans, and then Annie Oakley and her husband auditioned as sharpshooters for the Wild West show. And Cody hired them. And then it turned out that at that same time he had been courting Sitting Bull. And then, one thing led to another, and it turned out Annie Oakley and Sitting Bull were already friends. And that kind of facilitated the arrangements that Buffalo Bill was trying to make. I mean, if Annie Oakley hadn't already met Sitting Bull, I don't know that Sitting Bull would have even joined up with Buffalo Bill.
It's interesting. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Mm-hmm. You use the term, of course, blood brothers in the title.
Mm-hmm.
You want to elaborate a little bit on how you came to identify them that way as blood brothers?
Sure. Well, obviously I'm not referring literally to their right. blood. I mean, they're not blood relations, but I'm talking about a shared history that they had, you know, a history of violence, of wars between their cultures. Both men had a lot in common, not just this violent clash that their people were experiencing, but they were revered inside their own world. They were fathers, they were husbands, mm-hmm. they were icons to their own people. Mm-hmm. They were hugely influential. They, in a lot of ways, at some point they became trapped in their own personas. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were so mm-hmm. famous mm-hmm. that they didn't really have much room to maneuver mm-hmm. near the end of their lives. I realized as I was writing this, they couldn't really be themselves. I mean, Buffalo Bill kind of got tired of, you know, being a showman and kind of always being on and having to be, you know, this bigger than life character. And Sitting Bull, I think, was, you know, he was obviously a leader of his people, but he felt they were both kind of, he became in some ways a prisoner of perception of the way mm-hmm. he was perceived by white people and, you know, some people in his own tribe. I mean, again, he was blamed for killing Custer. And that was his persona to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, among his own people, he was certainly hugely revered. But as he became older, you know, a lot of, you know, old people are often thrown overboard. And that was going on too.
Yeah.
So when I say blood brothers, I mean that they had a very deeply shared history. And you know, they were war veterans. They both brought that to, you know.
And Bub and Sitting Bull was only 4 months with him in 1885.
That's right.
We think of, you know, oh, they were together, you know, for years because you see the iconic photographs and such, and you think it's like, oh no, they were only four months.
Well, actually, it was October 11th. It was this week that Sitting Bull had his last appearance with Buffalo Bill in St. Louis, and that was where Buffalo Bill presented him with the horse that he rode as he was preparing to return to Standing Rock. You know, and of course that was the big deal, the gift of the horse.
Right.
And Sitting Bull by then, you know, he had been wanting to go home. One of the reasons he joined up with Buffalo Bill was because Cody promised him that they would get to Washington, D.C., and that Sitting Bull would meet the grandfather, a.k.a. the president. And Sitting Bull had been wanting to do that so he could ask the president how come none of the treaties were being honored. And they did get to D.C., and some Native Americans in the Wild West cast did meet with State Department officials. But they never did get to meet with a president. I have a scene in my book where they're in an office. They're in somebody's office in the State Department, and there's all this frontier art on the walls, you know, like buffalo and just wide open space and you know, depictions of where the Lakota and other Native cast members lived, you know, before they were moved onto reservations. And evidently when the Indians were shown into that room and they looked at the artwork and started laughing. And all except Sitting Bull, who apparently had no response. Mm-hmm. But you can imagine how strange that must have been. Or they've been on the road for months and months. Sorry, go ahead.
We are talking with our guest, Dan Stillman. It's so fun to have you with us tonight. We're going to take a short break. We're going to hear a little bit about Out West Shop. And when we come back, let's talk a little bit about your writing process. Don't go away.
Okay.
Here at the Out West Shop, we're passionate about the American West, the truth and the myth. We're purveyors of fine Western goods. We scout for unique and distinctive apparel, accessories, home decor, and general merchandise that are a reflection of the Western lifestyle. We hunt for unique artisans and craftsmen who are inspired to create decorative art you can wear based on their own love for the story of the West. We round it up and bring it to you. Check out OutWestShop.com when you need anything Western.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with the Writer with special guest tonight, Deanne Stillman. Okay.
So you have some questions about her writing process?
Let me tell you. I don't know how you do all this research. You know, it must have taken 20 years, I'm thinking.
Well, each of my books is years in the making. I mean, and when I'm finished, I mean, it's kind of like, wow, this wind. I mean, look back on what happened, it's like a wind came through. But, you know, during the time when I'm actually writing, it's quite arduous. But I love doing research, and I love going to the library and being out in the field and talking with people. So it's kind of, I don't know, it's just a function of my own natural curiosity. It's not like, oh, no, I have to look up some more stuff. So, but yeah, I mean, it's certainly a big part of my process. And I often find that one thing leads to another. I mean, for instance, when I was reading about Buffalo Bill's funeral, which was in Denver, and I found out that America's first traffic jam happened outside his funeral.
Oh my gosh.
Thought that was really interesting, because obviously it symbolized the end of the horse era. I mean, and that was what the Wild West show was all about. So here was this funeral attended by thousands, including white people and Native Americans. And, you know, here was this America's first traffic jam. And that was it was so symbolic to me.
I always
come across things that I, you know, certainly and hadn't been thinking about and would never have guessed, but there always are these surprises.
How do you decide when you have such a body of research and you sort of say, like, okay, I need to start writing, or are you already writing as you're gathering the research? And how do you know when you say, okay, enough is enough? I could keep researching, but I need to write. Like, how do you decide it's time to write?
Those are good questions. I kind of write as I go along. I mean, I take very extensive notes, and I come up with paragraph openings and just sort of pathways into the story, and I write all of this down. So I'm writing as I'm reading, or sometimes I'm just out walking and, you know, some sentences will occur to me and I try to stop and write them down. Or I'm in my car driving and I'll suddenly the way to open a certain chapter will occur to me, and yeah, I'll write it down. But this is all a function of being immersed, of being inside the material.
Mm-hmm.
How do I know when I've had done enough research?
That's part of it. Cause I would imagine things become, you know, a tangent to this thing and that thing. And then finally it's like, wait, I got to get back to my main purpose was.
Sometimes it's, you know, reading and reading and reading can become a way of not writing. So it's kind of hard to know when I've done enough, but often enough I get signs. Sometimes I'm working on material that's upsetting and I have to step away for a while, but there's always something that draws me back in. So that's kind of a sign that I need to get going. And or I start hearing from people that I had been trying to reach for months and months, and then finally they're ready to talk. And that always seems, that's always auspicious to me. It means, you know, I'm on the right track. Mm-hmm. So I just, a lot of my writing is instinctive. So these things kind of go on while I'm working. Kind of hard to explain beyond that.
Do you work on one project at a time, Deanne? Do you work on, you know, do you work on one book at a time, or are you sort of multitasking?
It's usually one at a time, but okay. In the case of Blood Brothers, as I mentioned, I found out while I was working on Mustang about the dancing horse outside Sitting Bull's cabin, and I knew that would be a book of mine at some point, so I did start making notes about that. I did, and then later when I was actually writing Blood Brothers, I called Chief Arvel Looking Horse, who was the, I think it's the 19th generation pipe keeper of the Lakota tribe. I'm not sure if I have the number right, but he's one of their spiritual elders. And I had met him while working on Mustang as well at a wild horse preservation event in Nevada. But I called him about Blood Brothers. I wanted to get his view on the that dancing horse outside Sitting Bull's cabin. And he told me something. It's in the introduction to Blood Brothers, which was excerpted in Newsweek, by the way. He told me something that really opened up a whole new pathway for me into Blood Brothers. And it was a conversation that took me in a direction. Just took me in a new direction. So
a new direction.
Grateful that we had that conversation. And I guess what I'm saying, I just never know. You know, I have a general idea of what I'm writing in terms of overall story, but I really never know what roads I'm going to be traveling en route.
We're going to take another short break because we know you, the listener or watcher, wants to find out how to find her books. So here's a little something about Out West Shops Bookshop. Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shops Bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story. And we're back, and oh my gosh, Deanne, I'm looking at the clock, and we're almost out of time. So So is there something you're working on now that you would want to share about, or is that always going to be a mystery till it's ready for coming out?
Yeah. Well, one book I could tell. You were asking about, do I work on two books at once, and I usually don't, but I am now. And one book I can tell you about right now is I'm working on a book called Ghost Cats, The Last Mountain Lions of Los Angeles.
Oh.
So it's a story. Did you know that LA is the only metropolitan area outside of Mumbai where mountain lions are roaming the perimeter?
I did not know that. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. So there's this, population of mountain lions, which live on the outskirts of LA and, of course, sometimes come into town. I mean, there's the famous P-22 who lives in Griffith Park, who's known as the Brad Pitt of mountain lions.
In Griffith Park.
He's kind of the face of the mountain lion preservation community. And at any rate, so this book is about their life here and what the perils are and efforts to save them. And there's the world's biggest wildlife crossing is under construction right now across the 101 freeway in Los Angeles.
Okay. We know that freeway. Deanne, thank you so much for being with us. Where can people get a hold of you? Website or Facebook?
Facebook or Twitter is the best way.
Or Twitter. Okay. Okay, very good. And we want to thank everybody for listening tonight and for watching if you've been watching us on the live stream. Next week, we have actually two featured guests joining us, author Peggy Chambers, and she'll be bringing along a friend of hers, screenwriter and author Renee Guterich, and that's going to be a lot of fun. You had a parting quote for tonight, Jim, didn't you?
Our quote for tonight Okay, it's from Sitting Bull. Each man is good in the sight of the Great Spirit.
Until we meet again next week, remember, it's always a great day.
Out west.
Out west.
Okay, thanks a lot, Jim and Bobby Jean. Great speaking with you.